From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. American public schools, once considered the envy of the world, are in deep trouble. Over the course of decades, schools have seen funding cuts, charter schools have eaten up dwindling resources without improving outcomes, and the debate over education has been reduced to testing, teacher accountability, and digital technology as a panacea. But my guest makes the case that public education in the U.S. was critical to the nation's founding and the idea of democracy in a way that has not been fully appreciated. Now, as our democracy is under threat after 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency, a movement to save public education is long overdue. Derek Black is a professor at the University of South Carolina's Law School, where he teaches constitutional law, civil rights, and education law. Professor Black founded the Education Rights Center at Howard University. He worked on civil rights issues for President Obama's transition team and eventually became one of the nation's leading experts on education law and policy. He is a well-known and outspoken advocate of the importance of public education, and his new book is called Schoolhouse Burning: Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. Welcome to the program, Derek.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So why is it that public education should be seen within the context of the founding of the nation and the idea of American democracy itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people don't fully know the history of public education. They think about its growth in recent decades. But if you go back to the founding of the nation, you know, America was a very radical idea. I mean, at that moment in time, in the late 1700s, the world was literally ruled by kings and queens and a handful of elites. And, you know, the Jeffersons and Adams of the world said, you know, look, we want to hand this over to regular people, but they've got to be educated, right? We had never seen a government that just handed over power to folks like that. So Jefferson and Adams in particular began working in their home states to create public education systems at that very moment, right? And John Adams actually authors the world's, or at least the nation's first constitutional education clause in Massachusetts, obligating Massachusetts to provide public education forever to its children. That constitutional obligation is still in place there today.
And so are you saying that at that time in the world, there weren't other governments that were using public resources to provide free public education?
Well, there were others. If you look at that time period, actually Prussia was making quite a bit of progress at that point. It was an older, more developed nation, but America became quickly a leader in that movement because they made these commitments that others weren't. So that by the time you get into the early 1800s, the only country in the world with more access to public education was Prussia.
And of course, we have to add in the massive caveat that this education was out of reach for enslaved people. And there were massive problems with, and the history, we have a really deeply disturbing history of education and in indigenous communities in this country. So the idea was solid. The implementation was, and always has been, of course, problematic.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I always focus on to say, look, America started with a real good idea and a long way to go. And as you point out, you know, I said handing political power over to regular people, that really meant white men with land. So, you know, African Americans, women, and to be quite frankly, even a lot of white men who didn't own property, they weren't really part of the political body overall. But there was the idea of everyone. And so America has been this reach from the get-go to continue to expand. And that's really the story of my book, is that each major moment in which America expands its democracy, it does that through public education in conjunction with the ballot and the right to vote.
So let's parse that a little bit more. Is it that as access to education is expanded, we see greater democratic and civic engagement, or is it that greater democracy leads to greater access to education?
Well, I think they are reciprocal, as you point out. But there is this fascinating study of New York during the late 1700s and early 1800s. And what they found was that the more political power that people held at the local level, the more they actually devoted to public education. So this idea of the broader the democracy was, the local level, the more effort that it put into expanding that democracy even further through public education. So, you know, I can't really tell you which is the chicken and which is the egg, but the two are certainly working very closely together.
So this idea that in order to have a democracy, which means that the public decides, that the residents of a nation, the citizens of a nation decide its direction, you have to have an educated citizenry. How has that relationship gone up and down, and more importantly, in recent decades, eroded? Do we see a correlation between the health of our democracy and the lack thereof and the ill health of American public education?
Yeah, I mean, I would say to take that sort of broad swath, you said, how does it go up? How does it go down? What we find, for instance, following the Civil War, that we create numerous new systems of constitutionally obligated education, right? And that is to bring millions of slaves into the political body, right? But then we see a retraction of that during Jim Crow, right? Fast forward into the 20th century, right? In Brown versus Board of Education, right? I think it's notable that the civil rights movement starts with schools. The idea there clearly is if we can unlock democracy through our schools, we will unlock the ballot, we will unlock economic opportunity and do all of those things to make African Americans full citizens. And then of course, rights for, you know, disabled students or students with disability, ELL students, all of those things follow after Brown as well. We also see backlashes following Brown, where people try to take back and undermine public education so as to restrict the ballot box, now to the modern day. And that's really the sort of cautionary tale that I'm trying to put out there, which is this isn't just about education, right? If education has been the key to expanding our democracy and having engaged citizens, those people going after public education right now are going after our democracy. They are going after the vote. We have seen this before. And so ultimately, you can see actually that people are going directly after the ballot as well today. So it's really a two-pronged approach. People always spot the ballot attack. I think people sleep on the role that public education plays in this broader movement.
We see in other nations where, say, women's rights are struggling to progress, that access to education is often very deeply correlated with women having better rights. So that when you have a citizenry that's educated and are aware of their rights, are empowered to access their rights, you have greater democratic engagement. But then you also have a threat to existing power structures that have relied on an unequal status quo. So let's go back, I mean, because a lot of your book is, of course, that history. It was very clear then from reading our history, we know that enslaved African Americans were, if they had access to education, if they knew how to read or write or were taught how to read or write, they were seen as a threat by the people claiming to own them, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you know, Denmark Vesey and others who had revolutions here in the South, it turned out after the fact that they were the most educated in their communities. And so slave owners said, look, you know, if education is somehow or another helping folks share information, plot insurrection, or at least have the gumption to engage in insurrection, we need to quash that. So there's the sort of white power structure side of that wanting to quash education. I should also say, and that's one of the things I think is the real beauty and heart of this book, is that I dug into the experiences of enslaved people here in the Confederacy and tried to say, well, how do they see this? What's their perspective on this? And it was very clear that education was the forbidden fruit, that they saw it that way. It was also the secret treasure that was kept in secret, that there were families that knew how to read and passed it on from generation to generation. I mean, the missionaries were shocked when they came South during the Civil War to find out how many people actually already had a rudimentary sense of how to read. And that's because those families, those individuals believed that that would allow them to share the information, to read the maps, to have the information, to maybe escape to freedom. So it literally was, in the minds of the enslaved people, the pathway to freedom.
Wow. Today, we have a school system that is in theory and on the books desegregated, and yet we have a de facto segregation with public schools, of course, depending upon the neighborhood, the city and the state. A lot of underfunded public schools have, you know, being the places where Black and brown students end up going, a lot of the elite public schools where white students going, and of course, white parents sending their kids to private schools. And so what has led to that? Do you see the cutting of funds of public schools directly correlated with a sort of resegregation, racial resegregation in our schools?
I think that the underfunding of schools contributes to segregation. I'll give you a perfect example, and I wrote a little essay about this in Gardendale, Alabama. A lot of people heard about this resegregation or secessionist district in Alabama, right, where a group of, a suburban white group of families in a relatively small neighborhood seceded from their school district to create their own space, right? And so much of the focus on that was the racist motivations of what was going on there and the segregative effects. But I wrote a piece that said, yes, but we have to also understand that the state of Alabama has created a system under which all of its schools are underfunded, or at least most of them are underfunded. And so they have created racial and socioeconomic competition for scarce resources. And you put that in a mix with racist motivations, you have communities that say, look, if the state isn't going to support our schools, if the state isn't going to guarantee quality public education, I'm not going to stick around here for my children, right? I'm going to try to leave. I'm going to try to isolate my schools and my finances from everyone else. So it is the case that underfunding of public schools, in my mind, incentivizes hoarding of resources and segregation.
You were part of President Obama's transition team around civil rights issues, and you write in your book about a choice that President Obama made for education secretary that is indicative of the direction that this nation and this nation's leaders are taking public education. Obama's education secretary ended up being Arne Duncan. Who do you think he should have chosen, and what did that decision represent?
Well, I hate to name names, but, you know, because I'm sure there's other great people out there. But, you know, Linda Darling Hammond was the choice of most educators, would have been my choice, you know, seasoned, well-educated, obviously, you know, voluminous knowledge and scope. And, and she's someone who wanted to reinforce the teaching profession, wasn't interested in charter schools. And there was an attack on her and her ideas, I think, from the right, and maybe also some centrist Democrats. And so, I don't know if President Obama had an agenda per se, or if he was just reacting to sort of political forces outside of him. And we have to remember, of course, you know, the housing market was in free fall, and the nation looked like it could implode economically at that moment. So I don't know how high up on his list, you know, that decision was. But nonetheless, his choice was Arne Duncan, who came in, as a superintendent who was not as immersed in the history and data and thinking around public education and teachers, but was a superintendent who had overseen enormous growth in charter schools in Chicago public schools. And so he comes in with a clear bias, it seems to me, of pro-charter schools and skepticism towards the teaching profession, or at least teaching unions. And those two factors played out throughout the Obama administration, where he basically forced states to have more charter schools, lest they lose federal funding. And he was applauding, you know, the attacks on teacher tenure and other things during his administration, and also requiring states to adopt new standardized tests to evaluate teachers with, which have subsequently proved to be invalid measures. But nonetheless, that was on his watch.
And then, of course, we had Trump, and we had his education secretary, Betsy DeVos. We still have her. She, you know, in an administration that has seen incredibly high turnover, Betsy DeVos came in being deeply criticized, but has managed to have quite serious staying power. Has she continued Arne Duncan's legacy, worsened it, turned it into a different direction? How do you view DeVos and public education today in the framework of this history that you've written about?
Yeah, well, first of all, you just sort of brought it to mind. I mean, I think 4 years of her, or rather 3.5 years of her, seems like a lot longer than 8 years of Arne Duncan. So mm-hmm. I have my criticisms of Duncan, but I do think he was, generally speaking, a well-meaning person. He did want to improve our public schools. DeVos, on the other hand, comes in with a clear agenda to attack our public schools. She talks of them as dead ends. She talks of the money being spent on them as a waste of money. She calls them government schools in a pejorative sense. She calls those of us who support them flat earthers. So she clearly
flat
comes in with
earthers. Wow.
Flat earthers. Yes. And so she comes in with a clear agenda to attack those and attack teachers. And I think actually telling is just the interaction she had with teachers in very conservative states. Those small meetings were quite contentious because she was so disrespectful of the teaching profession. But her larger agenda was really the privatization. So when she comes through as the Secretary of Education, her goal is what she calls broadly student choice. And by that, she meant charters and vouchers. So in that respect, at least on the voucher, I mean, on the charter, she is continuing the Duncan agenda, who vastly expanded charters. But what we've seen over the last year and a half or two is that she's basically stopped talking about charters at all. She's actually upset some of them because she wanted to move more funding away from them, because her sole agenda at this point is the creation of private school choice, that we should do away with public systems of schools and move as much money as possible, as quickly as possible, into private education, to let the market completely control the quality of education that our children receive.
So we, of course, today have this crisis with the coronavirus pandemic, a crisis of this magnitude we have not seen in about a century. And the pressure on schools and teachers and children and parents is incredibly high. We're seeing projections that existing education gaps between white children and children of color, between wealthier children and low-income children, are getting exacerbated. Do you worry that this pandemic may really be a nail in the coffin of public education?
A nail in the coffin of public education. I think this pandemic has ripped the scab off of a wound, which is to say, we had tons of inequality, we had tons of segregation, we have tons of underfunding before this pandemic. And many of us could go about our daily lives without noticing that, right? Depending on where we live. But I think what we see here is the technology gap gets fully exposed, where there's only about half of the kids that have good, reliable access to internet and all the technology they need at home to support it. We also see that some families can hire tutors, some families can form pandemic pods, and that those folks can move on quite easily. So what we really have is an exposure, right? That the curtains have been pulled back and we can see those inequalities more than ever before. We also have, troublingly, you know, the Secretary of Education trying to exploit the crisis, right? So I think Congress and I thought, well, you know, for one moment, she will put her agenda aside. We literally are in a pandemic. Congress has authorized, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with the pandemic and directed a lot of it at public schools. She'll just do her job. But what we saw was that as soon as those checks were cut, she was already thinking up schemes as to how to redirect that money from public schools to private schools. There's been litigation about that recently, and she's lost those cases. But it's really just amazing that someone in the middle of a pandemic would try to leverage crisis for their agenda. So we see her pushing and pushing. We also see, which is the nature of crisis, is that, you know, all families have needs and all families' needs are different. And most of us, understandably, are going to focus on those needs that are right in front of us at the moment. And so, unfortunately, the pandemic, when it comes to education, is creating a system or incentives for people to look out for themselves. And that is, I think, further exacerbating inequality. The question really is, will that persist after the pandemic? And how much learning will disadvantaged kids lose during the pandemic? And I don't have good answers to either one of them. I think it's going to be very hard to make up the learning that the disadvantaged students have missed. But on the question of whether those families will come back to public education, I have to remain hopeful. And one of the big stories that I tell in the book is that we've seen bad times before. We saw Jim Crow segregation and the attempt to return African Americans to second-class citizenship following Reconstruction. We saw a massive backlash to Brown and the Civil Rights Movement during the 70s, in which Virginia literally tried to close its entire state system and authorize vouchers instead. And in both of those very dark moments in time, it was actually our public schools actually made it through, right? That rather than end public education following the Reconstruction, former slave owners said, you know what, I think we ought to keep this thing around. And following the backlash to Brown versus Board of Education, white suburban mothers in Richmond said, if our choice is between doing away with public schools and desegregating public schools, we will reluctantly take desegregating public schools. So we see that there is something about public education that is in the fiber of who we are as America. And I gotta hope, I gotta believe that it's something that people still believe that's worth fighting for. And although we are at a tipping point, we are at a dark moment, I can't help but remember the tens of thousands of people in the streets in 2018 and 2019 marching on state capitals in red states, very red states, right? Kentucky, West Virginia.
You're talking about the teacher walkouts.
But there was also a lot of parents and kids out there marching with them in Oklahoma, right? And those voices, I believe, are still going to be with us on the other side of this pandemic. And so I think they call us to our better angels, to use that phrase.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court, where a lot of decisions around education and the access to public education have been made. There's a big fight over the direction of the Supreme Court in the current moment that we are in. We have a Supreme Court, potential Supreme Court justice who is just found to be sitting on the board of a Christian private school that banned LGBTQ students from attending or teachers from teaching there. Do you worry about a conservative tilt on the court leading to worse outcomes for public education? Does the Supreme Court play a deeply important role that we need to worry about?
Well, I mean, on LGBTQ youth, I think that there is risk there. I mean, that has been a movement that's been gaining steam. And we had a decision this summer. It was in an employment context, but I've written in my new casebook, right, enormous implication for public schools. It's pretty clear, right, that now LGBTQ youth have all the protections that folks have been arguing for in public schools. And so that's important. But her ascendancy to the Supreme Court does change a vote on that issue. And so that's in jeopardy. But in the larger scheme of public education, I would say two things. You know, the Supreme Court got out of the desegregation business 25 years ago, so it just can't get much worse when it comes to that. So unfortunately, you know, it is what it is. What folks have been fighting for and trying for, particularly over the last decade, was to find a federal fundamental right to education in the Constitution. And if you can think back to the good old days of 2016, when it seemed like Hillary Clinton was about to win the election, a lot of folks thought, right, by replacing Antonin Scalia, that we might have a chance after all these years to have a justice to who would protect the right to education. I think those dreams were dashed with, you know, President Trump's election, and they just got worse they're getting worse with the current nomination, which leads me to say, you know, we were already down a couple of points, so to speak, and we're just down more points now. Mm. And so I don't want to minimize it. It is, you know, I'd rather be close to being in the game than way down. And I just think what we're going to be is way down in the game.
So finally, moving forward, if you could articulate a wish list for what it's going to take to bring American public schools back to their full potential, which of course in turn strengthens our democracy, what would you ask for? Do we need to put charter schools to bed? Do we need to dramatically increase funding to schools and, you know, support teachers, et cetera? How would you articulate that?
Yeah, well, we do need to dramatically increase funding, and people have heard that over and over again. There's a little bit of cynicism about it. So I actually would say what we need is for every state in the country or the federal government, one or the other, to do an annual assessment of what it actually costs to deliver an adequate education to every child in California or Arizona or wherever it may be. Most states have absolutely no idea They pull a number out of the hat each year, largely based upon what they're willing to spend, and say, that's what we're going to spend on public schools. Well, as we can all see, they've been willing to spend less and less each year. But I think a public armed with the information of actually knowing what's the gap between what children need and what my state is actually doing is very important to correcting that problem. And I think if we have fully funded schools, we tend to get into the position to cure a lot of other problems, right? One of those being segregation. I talked earlier about how underfunding incentivizes segregation. We have to fix segregation. We have to have more integrated schools. The first step is equaling the financial field. And then we're in the position to begin integrating schools in such a way that people don't feel like it's a zero-sum game where there's going to be winners and losers. So I think we have to have those two things in place. And I think with those two things in place, we can begin to attract and pay teachers a reasonable salary. I mean, right now, and folks in California know it as well as anywhere, I mean, the number of students going to schools of education to become teachers is down like 50, 60% in places like California. So there is no hope for the future of public education if we don't have teachers to put in those classrooms. And so that's partly about money. It's partly about segregation. It's partly about respecting the profession.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Derek Black, for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Derek W. Black, a professor at the University of South Carolina Law School, where he teaches constitutional law, civil rights, and education law. And we've been discussing his new book, Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.